our author of the week interview, as always, made possible by ABC Books on North Glenstone, just south of Kearney. Great folks, great people. They've been making this possible longer than I've been hosting the show, which is over a decade. So that tells you the sort of commitment they have, not only to you, but to the community and making sure that you get to hear from authors every week. Kevin Hassett, he was a top White House economics advisor to President Donald Trump, and he's got a book out called The Drift, Stopping America's Slide to Socialism. I want to thank you for being with us, and it's my understanding it was actually a surprise that you ended up being requested for this position. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, thanks. It's great to be here. And it's wonderful to see, you know, a bookstore out there that's not part of a huge change,
yeah,
you know, keeping books alive in a municipality. But yeah, I was an economist, worked at the American Enterprise Institute, a top conservative think tank, had been an advisor for John McCain for many years, and also Mitt Romney and George Bush. And I was sort of surprised when President Trump called me up and asked me, and of course honored, to be the chairman of his Council of Economic Advisors. And I didn't know him well, you know, was a little anxious about what he might be like after seeing, you know, the way they cover him on TV.
Yeah.
And went in and then just found that I love the guy. We really got along very well. I spent, you know, hundreds of hours at the Oval, and even like, you know, casual moments shooting the breeze. I was sitting right across from him in the Resolute desk when Robert Kraft sent him a Super Bowl ring after the Patriots won the Super Bowl. And we just went through a lot together. And I just, yeah, was very, very surprised at how different he is in person from, you know, the guy you see on TV.
Did a lot of...
And that's what really the first half of the book is about, by the way. It's like a lot of sort of, what was it like? What was he like?
Did you have colleagues saying, don't do this, it's going to be suicide?
You know, the thing about it is that, you know, my history is that I'm a sort of free market, free trader kind of guy. I had even written about immigration where I, you know, agreed with Ronald Reagan and think that, you know, we should have a big expansion of legal immigration, you know, with lots of rules and stuff. And so there were a lot of people like at Breitbart that criticized President Trump when he appointed me because they said that I would be like fighting his agenda. And one of the first things President Trump did, and it shows what he's like, is that when I got there and started working in the White House, he called me into the back room behind the Oval, and he said, you know, there are a lot of people that don't want you here. And so I'm thinking, okay, I'm about to get fired. And then he said, but don't worry, I got your back. And then that was like the end of the meeting. And I walked out of the hall, and I just happened to see Ivanka there. And I said, Ivanka, what does that meeting mean? He's telling me I shouldn't be here because a lot of people don't want me here. And he said, no, he told you he's got your back, so he's going to have your back. He doesn't say that to anybody. And then he did. For the whole time I was there, he had my back. And there were times when he disagreed with me, but he wants, like, really vibrant debate in the Oval when he's making a decision. So he kind of knew that he's tariff man. I wasn't at the beginning, but I really began to understand the wisdom of his policies over time. But in between, he actually wanted to watch me argue with Peter DeBarrow at
When he was running and he was making promises, if you will, or predictions about his policies, and this is what will happen, and the media, of course, you had Obama out there saying, you know, now somewhat famously, what are you going to use, a magic wand, you know, saying that those days are over, we're never going to have that sort of economic growth again, and the news outlets would have experts on, and even, you know, economists from the Bush administration and others that said those are pipe dreams, those things will never happen. And then, of course, much of it did happen. Did you, right, like at the time he got elected, think that these things were possible, he was asserting, and was there any sort of evolution as you worked with him in the Trump administration in terms of what you saw was possible and what would come to fruition with the economy under his policies?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And the basic reason that the president asked me to join him is that as an economist, I had spent decades as a free market economist in the tradition of Milton Friedman. I had spent decades talking about how tax cuts and deregulation in particular would help low-wage, low-income, blue-collar workers. And that's exactly the people that, you know, President Trump wanted to help the most. And you might recall, like, during the tax cut debate, President Trump said, if we pass these tax cuts, then the typical family's wage will go up by $4,000. He said that all the time. That was a number that grew out of my research. And so on deregulation and tax cuts, you know, I was the person out there, you know, making the case. And the people who were arguing against me, they were just wrong. Like, they didn't have their science right because, and this is the other part of the drift, our universities have been taken over by socialists. And so, you know, don't think that economics is a science. You know, they call it a dismal science. I say that's not fair because it's not a science. You know, what's happened is it's been taken over by socialists who want to say that you can tax the heck out of everything and it's not going to harm the economy. And they do that with fake science. And so I stood up to them with the president. We got the stuff through. I had to convince a lot of reluctant senators. I talk about this in the book, like Senator Corker. But then once the stuff became law, it worked exactly the way we said. The place where I grew and changed radically, and the New York Post excerpted this part of the book. And so for those of you who are looking something, if you Google my name in New York Post, you can see a piece I wrote. There's an excerpt from the book that the New York Post ran this week. It was on trade. And the thing about trade is that, you know, if you're a free market guy like Milton Friedman, you think, oh, free trade, free trade, free trade. And Donald Trump was talking about how we're getting screwed by all the trade deals, right? And as I started to participate in the trade meetings every Tuesday, which at times were really contentious, I started to understand that, especially from the Chinese, you know, we really are getting screwed in the trade deals. The president was right about it. And you could even look at, like, data that showed that, you know, the places where China had, like, shut down American factories, were having, like, serious substance abuse problems. And then we did a report that, you know, I spearheaded that showed that the Chinese were stealing hundreds of billions of dollars of our intellectual capital every year. And so I would say that I agreed with them at the beginning on taxes and deregulation, and we made lots of progress really early on because I had been working on it forever, and so we were teed up to sort of fire the ammo, you know, that we needed to get those things to happen. And then on trade, you know, I thought that he was wrong at the beginning, but then understood at the end that he was right.
And that is an area where there, I think, good intellectual debate, free trade, and then you talk about the way that Trump approached it. Is it fair to say, I know this is sort of broad, but that it's not really free trade if you're dealing with a country that doesn't really believe in capitalism so much. Is that a fair way to look at it?
Yeah, or another way to say it is that if you and I were competing for business of, you know, selling apples, and you got, like, really efficient at making apples, you know, because they're hard to get out of the tree, and you make a machine that gets them out of the tree, and I'm picking them with expensive workers or something like that, then you would kind of put me out of business because you'd have lower prices. But if we had the sort of same technology and you charged lower prices for apples, then you'd lose money probably. And you'd go out of business, right? And so if you're going to capture the Apple market, you got to lose money for a long time unless you have some kind of amazing advantage. The Chinese don't have an amazing advantage. If there's technology out there, they're copying it from us.
Yeah.
But what they do is they'll go into a market, they'll lose money for years and years and years, and then capture the whole market and then start to price like a monopolist. But so there's an example that we talk about in some book that the Chinese, for example, stole the intellectual property for the guys who make solar panels to, you know, generate electricity on your roof. They just stole the technology. The WTO ruled against them and said, yes, they really did steal the technology. But then once they had the technology, they built these big factories in China, put all the solar panel companies in the U.S. out of business, and now they have 100% of the market. And the point is that if you've got a government-run, you know, centrally planned organization with a long-run goal, they could lose money much longer than a business, ordinary business could. And this is one of the reasons why so much of the U.S. economy has been gutted.
Our author of the week, Kevin Hassett, he's a top economic advisor to former President Donald Trump. The book is The Drift, Stopping America's Slide to Socialism. During the last election in particular, there were a number of people at generally younger people that would take to social media. They would create videos, and these were generally people from Venezuela that were trying to warn Americans, listen, you don't want to go the route of socialism. You don't want to do this. And what was particularly interesting is their resume, if you will, that gave them validity in this argument was that people from Cuba used to say this to us and we did not listen. We would have people from Cuba come here and say, you don't want to go this route. We didn't listen. So we're warning you, listen to us like we didn't listen to them. Obviously, some people don't. There's also, of course, as you know, a tremendous amount of misinformation, the false claim that there are successful socialist countries in Europe, which are actually welfare states, are not really socialist. What do we do to stop it? Because clearly the people who are in charge at the federal level right now are heading as quickly as they can in that direction. How do we stop that slide?
Right. And this is actually the segue in the book from going about like the inside stories of getting to know Donald Trump to thinking about, well, what is his place in history? And I think that basically the story for why people hate him so much in the media and at universities and did everything in their power, you know, even like outside of the Marquess of Queensberry rules to try to destroy him, is that it really is the case that our institutions in the U.S., our universities, most media outlets, certainly not you, have been taken over by socialists. And they're really radical socialists that want to basically centrally plan our country and have all the power. And you can see it in lots of the proposals, even in Joe Biden's Build Back Better plan right now. And I think that, you know, for the longest time, if a conservative said about a liberal, oh, you're a socialist, then it was like almost a dirty trick. It's like using a swear word, you know, it's an ad hominem attack. But the fact is, and this is what I cover in The Drift, if you study carefully what they're saying, if you study what they're teaching at the universities, you can see that there's an intellectual elite that pretends to control respectability. And you're basically not reputable if you defend capitalism. And if you do defend capitalism, then they try to cancel you and insult you and bully you. And so in the second half of the book, I think expose the core problem that our country has right now, which is that there's this extreme, potentially totalitarian, radical elite. Like if I were to go to a campus, right, I'd get shouted down. People would try to beat me up because I'm a conservative. And those people have an outsized influence on the Democratic Party and the American media, and they're making our country shrill and potentially leading it off a cliff. And it's really important that we recognize what they're doing, who they are, and we collectively stand up to them. And that's why I wrote the book.
So is there hope?
Yes. And the reason that there's hope is that they can't cancel all of us. And so I think that, you know, if we all think about what it is that's happening, if we study and actually like call the socialist socialists, when we look at the socialist policies, like, so for example, in the Build Back Better plan, do you realize that Joe Biden's proposing that they build 1 million homes and the government becomes a landlord? That's the government provision of, you know, a service that should happen to the private sector. They're gradually trying to take over the private sector with the government, and we have to stop them from doing it. But most importantly, we need to recognize that when people like Donald Trump fight them, then what happened to Donald Trump, they're going to try to do that to whoever stands up to fight them again. You might think, oh, it would be great if we had a defender of capitalism that didn't tweet the nasty things that Donald Trump tweeted. Well, Donald Trump just had the courage to stand up to them and fight back. And anyone who doesn't have the courage to fight back, that tries to stand up to them, is going to get crushed. And so, you know, we need to make a safe space, really, for people who defend capitalism and pursue policies like Donald Trump did. And again, in the book, I go into deep detail about how successful the sort of normal American traditional policies of deregulation and tax cuts were at helping the little guy. Again, income inequality declined under Donald Trump. Wages grew faster than they had just about ever. African-American unemployment was the lowest since World War II. All of the things that the left asserts they advocate that support social justice happened, and yet they were mum about it. You ask yourself, well, why didn't they at least say, oh, well, maybe we should think about why income inequality went down under Donald Trump? No, they don't want capitalism to make the world a better place because they want socialism. They don't care so much about income inequality. What they want is control of our society. And that's, you know, that's really the case that's made in the book, and it's described in great detail. And I really do encourage people to have a look and think about what they can do to stand up to it. But I think the most important thing is to be outraged when somebody like you gets bullied by left-wingers for advocating, you know, capitalist solutions, which you know work.
Yeah. So, final question with our author of the week, Kevin Hassett, who is a top economic advisor to Donald Trump, and his book is The Drift, Stopping America's Slide to Socialism. And this will be back the first half of the book. I do like that you wrote about Trump, and there are so many books out there that are about Trump, but a lot of them are trash. You know, there are people just trashing on him, trying to make a buck. The point of your book is not Trump. And so, you know, to me, it's pretty straightforward then. There's no sort of hidden agenda. And that I really like. Was there ever any sort of moment that occurred with Trump that you saw that, I don't know, either clicked with you or thought, wait a minute, this guy, oh, I wish people knew this, or this guy really knows what he's doing.
Oh, yeah, there are a million examples of this in the book, and you're right, that I'm not a person who's in there to settle scores with the people I disagreed with in the White House, but I do think that history requires that somebody like me just write a true account of what it was like in the White House and, you know, where I think he fits in history. And you know, one example of this is that he loved my chief of staff was from New York, just like him. And she would come to the meetings of the Oval Office when I came to meetings of the Oval Office. And the two of them really hit it off. And my job as Council of Economic Advisors Chair was to go into the Oval Office and to show him the data that were coming out often the next day. The CEA chair is the only person in the country that gets the data a day before. And so it's very, very highly classified. And I would go to the Oval and we would talk about the data and how the economy's doing. And I had, you know, thousands of those, or at least hundreds of those conversations with him. Well, one day I was in Paris for a meeting at the OECD. And one of the other economists at CEA, I told the president was going to have to talk to him about the jobs report. And he said, no, I don't want to talk to an economist. Just send DJ, my chief of staff. And so DJ was really nervous that she had to go in and brief the president because she's not an economist. But she knew, you know, the jobs report better than anybody. She was going to do fine. That morning, she gets up, and as she's walking in to her car to drive into the White House to brief the president, she's so nervous and distracted, she steps in a pothole and really badly breaks her leg.
Oh.
And then she goes to the White House because she's tough as nails. She limps into the Oval. She briefs the president about the jobs report. And then she limps out and she goes to the hospital and gets a cast on. And when the president found out about this, he wrote her the sweetest note you ever saw. And that was something that I saw over and over. One of my other staffers got colon cancer. And, you know, as soon as the president found out, there was a handwritten note sent to that guy, how much he cares for him, how proud he is of his service, and how he wants him to get back and be healthy as soon as possible. That's a side of the president that I think you never read about in the media or hear about on CNN. But, you know, it's one reason why everybody that, you know, stuck around, the group of us that were there for almost the long haul, we just loved working with the guy because he's a very good boss, a very sweet person, caring person, and super fun and humorous and funny too. But I think the story of like the person who sends notes to lower level employees if he finds out they're sick, I think that's something that the world needs to know about Donald Trump. Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing it. The book as well. Our author of the week, Kevin Hassett, The Drift, Stopping America's Slide to Socialism. I really appreciate being with us this morning.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you for the time.
Absolutely. And of course, that and all our past Author of the Week books you can get through ABC Books on North Glenstone. Of course, they have so many of them in stock. But if for whatever reason they sell out, then they can order those and get those to you very, very, very quickly. ABC Books, North Glenstone, just south of Kearney. Springfield's Talk 104.1. I'm Nick Reed.